Come to order. We're getting started right away because we've given everybody 10 minutes for presentation and 5 minutes for questions, so we'll move along. And then members and people in the audience, just to be absolutely sure, if there are groups from out of town, and we might move people up the, just to make sure we get everyone in who's here from out of town. We maybe every single area has something like that. I'm not sure, but Representative Ward is our first one up, and Representative Ward, do we have this one in our possession? Yes. This one we have in our possession, so Representative Ward will actually move House File 110 just to be held over for possible inclusion. We're not voting on anything, but most of these are informational. Otherwise, we're holding them over. Representative Ward, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So, Madam Chair, I move that House File 110 be laid over for possible inclusion in the possible omnibus bill.
And even though we know you, for the record, for the tape to pick you up, if you would introduce yourself.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Representative John Ward from District 10A. Madam Chair, I'm before you today and the committee to ask you to consider a bonding request of $150,000 appropriation to put an elevator into our Brainerd Area Civic Center. And I'd just like to give you some background on this. And, Madam Chair, I do have some handouts, and if the pages could hand those out, I'd appreciate it, with some letters of support and just some general information for the committee members. Madam Chair, we have an Area Civic Center, a Brainerd Area Civic Center that was built in the mid-70s by a group of civic-minded individuals who raised over $1 million to build it. And members, at that time, the ADA accommodations were not required in the 70s when this was built. So there was no elevator in this building at that point. The city required ownership of the building in 1996 from that nonprofit association that had built the facility. The city turned the management over to the Brainerd Area Hockey Association. The Brainerd Hockey Association then built an adjoining second sheet of ice from 1998 to 2000, and at that time, members, an elevator shaft was put in as part of the construction, but not the total elevator. The city assumed ownership of the adjoining, what we call the Gold Medal Arena, and the reason we call it the Gold Medal Arena, members, is because the boards and the glass in that arena were purchased from Lake Placid from the 1980 Olympics of that gold medal team. The problem is that the Civic Center, the total facility, is not handicap accessible to parts of the building, especially the upper part of the arena where the bathrooms, where there's a concession stand, where there's a warm viewing area.
Thank you.
Current accommodations are being made in order for those arena guests, Civic Center guests, to get to that area include two people carrying a wheelchair person up a flight of steps, side by side, we took some measurements, and those steps are 77 inches wide. If you take three people in a wheelchair, accounting for about 36 inches each of each person, you know, some maybe like Representative Davids and myself a little wider, some maybe a little bit thinner like Representative Dean and Dean. But a wheelchair, 36 inches, three people, that's far more than the 77 inches. So you can imagine, members, what a dangerous situation that is, trying to get a handicapped person up into a more comfortable area. And it's not only dangerous, it's humiliating to some extent, to a large extent as well. And not just wheelchair people, seniors that, you know, have walkers, have canes, or disabled folks, just, you know, that have a tough time with their gait or with their walking ability. So the request for the state bonding is to fix this situation by providing and installing an elevator into the shaft that was built when the Gold Medal Arena was built. The work includes creation of an elevator equipment room, completion of the elevator shaft, creation of upper level ramps and elevator landing area, and a connection between the Civic Center, the old Civic Center, and the new, what we call, Gold Medal Arena. Now, members, this facility, although it has two hockey rinks in it, it also is a community facility that has multiple economic uses for our area. And the Hockey Association itself brings in guests and visitors, over 25,000 guests and visitors annually to our area from a five-state area for hockey camps, for tournaments, for anything related to hockey. There's also 1,500 skaters ages 8 to adult that use that facility, along with some professional hockey players taking part in using that facility. The high school, the Brainerd High School, and other area high schools run their hockey programs out of there. There's a city broomball activity that takes place at the arena. And then, of course, there's private rentals. And we, you know, because we are in a recreation area, we get a lot of visitors or seasonal people that have places there. And so, like, Christy Yamaguchi and Brett Hedekin have used our facility on a private rental basis. But it's not only about hockey. We also do many, many dry land events in that arena for our community. We have had concerts there with many, many people attending them. We have had builders' home shows. We have a Chamber of Commerce that runs their what they call their market show place. We have sports and RV shows. We also have hosted boxing events, a women's expo, arts and crafts shows, and many, many, many more what we call drive floor events. And members, this brings in over 15,000 people to our area annually, which has a huge economic impact on our area, obviously. And then, you know, to have the total building not accessible, you know, does cause some problems. And we've heard from disabled folks attending these events, you know, is there a way that that you folks can fix this? Now, the Brainerd area, Madam Chair, members, as you've heard me harp and harp and harp over and over again, is pretty economically strapped. We are the highest, have the highest unemployment rate in the state, the city of Brainerd proper. Number one, we don't want that rating anymore. We're number one 6 straight years. So we have some of the highest unemployment. We have higher than average poverty level. Our homes in the city of Brainerd, more than 55%, there's 50+% of them are rental homes rather than owned homes. You know, we have a tough, tough economic situation there. And the city of Brainerd has had to cut down due to a loss of local government aid and things as such. They've had to cut their staff and resources by 20% over the past 3 years. So it has been difficult to try to correct this problem. So, Madam Chair, we have tried to raise a private fundraise, and to date we started the fundraising on July of 2012, and the Brainerd community, even though we're pretty economically strapped, is a community that really reaches out and tries to improve its whole area by reaching deep into their pockets. So far we've only raised $3,400 on about $150,000 project. We will continue to raise what we can. Madam Chair, members, you know, we understand that there are many requests, and especially in many arenas and civic centers in the area, in the state, that have, you know, received, you know, and rightfully so, some help in Duluth, in Crookston, in Bemidji, in Fergus Falls, much more than the $150,000 that we're asking for. And so, members and Madam Chair, I will just leave it at that and be available for questions. And again, I ask for your support on a facility, a very important facility in our community, to make it accessible to all people. And of course, you know, I have a personal interest in our disabled community and those that are handicapped, and having, you know, all handicap accessible facilities in our community. So having said that, Madam Chair, I think I'm probably at my time limit, so I'll entertain any questions.
So, members, I'll give a little background on this. Long before I was part of this committee, apparently a similar kind of situation must have evolved around libraries around the state. And I believe it's in the Department of Education. There is a program that we have bonded for called Library Accessibility Grants. And we don't often put money in, and we don't put a lot in, but we've put like $1 million or $2 million in. And we did check with the department, and that is routinely applied for. And so in the area of libraries, we have had this statewide fund available, library accessibility grants. So when Representative Ward brought this issue to us, and any time you have an issue like this that would have the potential of opening floodgates, you look around for what are the solutions. We have talked to both Deed and admin, if you did a similar kind of situation with this, some sort of grant program that would be available broadly, where would it most appropriately belong? And so we've had some good advice from them, and we're still working on trying to to figure out how we might craft some language, and we could certainly, when we get some ideas, bring those back to you to see how they might work in a bonding bill. So we're working on it. Your letters are compelling. There are some quite amazing stories in here. So I think you've brought an issue to us that that we shouldn't just disregard, but to say, is there a program we could devise something like the library accessibility grants? So when we after we've worked with some of the departments, we'll bring some language back and see if it works.
So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward, as a father of three hockey-playing sons, I do have some empathy for what you're talking about today. And as I understand it, you've got the shaft, but no elevator at the present time.
We've been shafted, Representative Erdahl. That's correct.
In doing some, Madam Chair, in doing some material I have reading on this, what is the cost of the elevator? $150,000, or I saw something here that's it's $40,000 to $50,000 for the elevator. Is that what are these numbers?
Madam Chair,
you can.
I'm sorry. we're planning our next agenda item here.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl. The cost came from the city folks who have investigated, the total project for not just the elevator, but for some ramping, for some elevator landing, for a elevator storage room that I guess is required. The total project is $150,000, and Representative Erdahl, they've assured me that not the money wouldn't be used for anything other than that purpose only.
Madam Chair, I see that they received $250,000 in a loan from the city of Brainerd recently. Do you know what that was for? We've been made aware, I guess, with other bills and personal experience that air exchange systems are, especially with arenas built in the 1970s, are a big issue. Have they replaced their air exchange system, or is that yet to come?
And Chair, Representative Erdahl, I do not know what that. Representative Erdahl, do you know who that was? You said the hockey arena received a $250,000 loan from the city.
Yes, that's
Representative Erdahl.
From to the hockey association.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I do not know what that $250,000 was for, but I do know this, Representative Erdahl. There are continual updates going on at that arena to address the concerns that you have, air exchange, and I think in Legacy we've talked about that recently, about some of the arenas and civic centers in the area, in the state, that are having problems with the gases given off by the Zambonis and things as such or whatever. So I don't have the answer specifically for what that's for, but I know there's been lots of upgrades going on throughout the every year with that civic center.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Ward, it might be good for future discussion if you were to ask them what they have been spending this money on.
Okay, I will, Representative. Okay,
thank you.
Representative Detmer, and then we're going to move on.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Norton was first.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm curious. You talked a little bit about the need for, particularly with ADA accessibility. I mean, that's a 1970s federal program. Law that was put in place, and I can't believe over the years we have not had some sort of bonding support to help folks come into compliance with ADA. We've never, I mean, maybe not in this state, somewhere in the country there has got to have been a bonding support for ADA, and I guess I know new facilities when they come on have to be ADA compliant, but it seems to me it would be fairly simple to put in place some sort of program that would help community buildings that have a public purpose, as we would for bonding, that could help them all across the state become ADA compliant. And I guess I'm just looking even back further than even, maybe your time in the legislature. It just seems like the state would have had something in place to help.
We will do some more research on that in terms of past history and as part of our discussion with the department. So, good suggestion. Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick one. Representative Ward, just looking at their numbers, the people that that use the facility looks like is really being used. I just did a quick math. If you take, say there's 10,000 people that have gone through the facility in a year, looks like, if those numbers represent 1 year, I'm not sure if they do, that would be $15 a person. If you just charge the user fee that for that one time, that would cover the $150,000. You know, I don't know if the community has thought that either. So, just an idea. So.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for bringing this forward, and we'll do some more work on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And then we're going to take Representative Purcell and then Representative Davids. We're going to move your two bills up because all of your people are from out of town, and just to make sure we get them in. So Representative Purcell, I believe, is here. And again, House File 273 is just before us for as an informational. We don't have that bill in our possession. Welcome to the committee, and whoever is, if you have got, you have a couple of testifiers to join you at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I do have a couple of testifiers here. And appreciate this information hearing on House File 273. And just in the interest of getting the information out as succinctly as we can and leaving some time for questions here, I'm just going to be brief myself. And just to say that I've been working on this school trust fund land issue since I've been here at the legislature, and we've had quite a good effort and a real remarkable bill last year that had great bipartisan support. And what this 273 is intended to fill in a gap here where we have school trust fund lands that simply can't be pursued for their highest economic interest for various reasons. And just as an indication, there's about 150,000 acres of trust land under DNR management where the uses are prohibited for the generation of revenue. So we have to do something if we're going to try and build this school trust fund, which is my impetus here to make that trust fund as big as it can be. So that, with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to have the testifiers say a few words, and then we'll have some questions.
We have Don Arnosky from Audubon and Steve Chaplin from the Nature Conservancy. Mr. Arnosky, are you going first?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And please identify yourself.
My name is Don Arnosky. I'm the policy director for Audubon, Minnesota, and represent Audubon members across the state. Thank you for considering this bill for inclusion and for potential funding this year or in coming years in any bonding legislation that you may have. This represents an opportunity to create a win-win. This is good for school children in terms of the school trust fund. It's also good for school children and all of us in terms of preserving critical features of our natural heritage. As Representative Purcell indicated, there's at least 150,000 acres of school trust lands that have been identified as extremely high-value natural resource consequence, and therefore the DNR has put them in a status that is not able to generate revenue. An example of this might be designated old-growth forest. It can be boat launches. It can be lakeshore frontage, which is critical for fish and wildlife spawning and reproduction and lake quality. It can be native prairies that underlie, in some instances, that have gravel deposits, for example, that could be a potential revenue-generating source. But we have less than 1% of our native prairies remaining, and all the species and ecosystems connected with that. What we're suggesting here today, and as a couple of the letters that you've seen passed out, this is a broadly supported concept, both by people who primarily represent school children's interest, as well as my organization and others that primarily represent school children's and others' interest in the environment.
And members, I should call to your attention the letter from the School Boards Association is signed by Denise Dietrich, a name that except for the first-termers, should be familiar to you all. She worked on the school trust land issue while she was here, and now is apparently working for the School Board Association on the issue. And then the other letter, as you can see on the back side, too, there are significant numbers of signers for that. Continue.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a uniter bill. This is one where there's been a lot of disagreement over school trust policy, and there's been tension, as you may know, those of you who have been in the legislature more than just this first term. This is one where the School Board Association and conservation organizations are in agreement. This is a good way to go. It's my understanding that it's being viewed favorably by those in charge of administering the school trust land as well. So we encourage you at this point to give it a try, to let us see if we can use some of the funds to resolve some of these conflicts between high natural resource values and the fiduciary responsibility to generate revenue for school kids in this manner. And we like to believe that these are two Minnesota values that are held very, very highly across our population: protection of environmental treasures and environmental resources, and educating our kids. So from our perspective, this is very much a win-win, and encourage your support and any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chaplin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Chaplin. I am a senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy, but I'm also on the Prairie Plan Working Group. This is a coalition of 10 agencies and conservation organizations that has produced the Minnesota Prairie Landscape Conservation Plan. Now, specifically, the mission of the Nature Conservancy is to conserve the lands and waters on which all life depends. But I'd like to speak specifically in support of House File 273 to allow the DNR to acquire significant school trust lands for conservation purposes. We're particularly concerned with the 7,331 acres of native prairie that are found on school trust lands. Native prairie is land that's never been plowed and retains most of the native plant species that would normally occur there. It's no accident the school trust land supports so much native prairie, because when the school trust lands were set aside, in many cases more than 120 years ago, the prairie was much more common. And with the fairly light use and impact over the succeeding years, there are a fairly large amount, comparatively, of native prairie that's still found on school trust lands. And they truly are remnants of our prairie heritage. Similarly, there's more than 290,000 acres of lands of outstanding and high biodiversity significance as designated by the County Biological Survey. So that all of these lands are lands that have very high conservation values that deserve to be protected and maintained under conservation management. A lot of this could be jeopardized if a new standard of highest and best use was applied to these fragile and significant conservation lands. It's for this reason that we support the DNR's buyout of significant school trust lands to allow the management that will maintain the native prairies and other significant natural communities. We urge you to include funds in the 2013 capital investment bill for this purpose. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Purcell, how much, who's going to take title of this land? I was a little late, I apologize for that. Is the DNR going to take title of the land and have oversight of the land? And do they have capacity to add more to their duties they have now? I hear they're several million dollars behind in maintaining the state parks and things like that. And we are the third largest landowner in the United States today. There's a lot of people in the legislature saying, let's sell some, let's sell some. I don't happen to be one of those. But I've also walked through the prairie with you, I think. And when I was in Lasard Samson, is there any way we can get an easement from the school of trust land instead of taking title to it? Would that accomplish the same thing that you want to accomplish?
Who's the best person to answer that one? Representative Purcell?
Well,
I'm going to give it a shot here, but some of this, Representative Gunter, Madam Chair, Representative Gunter, of this property is already owned by the state that we're looking at buying out the trust. So, I think you probably heard that there may be additional acquisitions. Is that what?
Any
additional acquisitions? Yeah, I'm going to let somebody else handle that part of it. But there's, we know of about 150,000 acres of land that already owned by the state that has a high value, and as it was said, like maybe a boat landing. But what are we going to do with that? You know, so let's school trust land. How are we going to use it? We could put up a credit card pay as you go kind of a thing there for the kids, you know, and maybe that's not a bad idea. I don't know, but otherwise we could buy the trust out. The other question is on the other title here.
Why don't we have Representative Gunther wants to follow up?
Okay.
Did you want to follow up the trust a little more, and then
I would. I just look at the DNR's cup is overflowing. And I don't want to add to the problems they have. I'd like to see them dig themselves out of it somehow. Maybe we have to triple all our licenses or something. Make senior citizens pay $100 for a fishing license, whatever it needs.
Mr. Chaplin?
Madam Chair and Representative Gunther, all of this land is already owned by the state, and all of it is already managed by the DNR. So this is not adding anything to what they're currently doing. What it's doing is removing the requirement that they manage the lands to the highest and best use, other sorts of uses, so that they can continue the management for the conservation values on that land.
We have two more questions, Representative Moline and Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know if this would be to Representative Purcell or to one of the testifiers, but I was just wondering what would happen. Oftentimes the mineral rights are severed from the surface ownership of the land. What would happen in the case where the land would have severed mineral rights?
I'd defer if somebody knows an answer to that, if there's anybody from DNR.
Madam Chair, I suggest you might request Adam or Aaron Vandalindy from DNR answer that question. He's in the room here and is probably best qualified.
Is there an answer to that anyone in the room is prepared to give? And because this is a new concept, I mean, it occurs to me that there might be some members of the committee who would want to follow up with conversation, and I suspect that you would visit them in their office if they wanted more background on this. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron Vandalin, DNR School Trust Land Administrator.
And did you hear the question?
Yes, ma'am, I did. Madam Chair, Representative Moline, the severed mineral interest actually would remain in state ownership. It does cause a risk because the severed mineral interest is the dominant interest as opposed to the surface interest. So those lands with state-owned mineral interest would still remain open for mineral development. The school trust would still retain those mineral interests.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's been a while, but back when I chaired the Education Committee by virtue of chairing that, we were in charge of a special commission that dealt with school trust lands. And we used to deal a lot with DNR with land exchanges, where we would exchange land of equal value with the school trusts. And I'm just not sure why this change versus that approach, because we did keep the land within the public sector. But then I'm also interested, maybe this is a question of Mr. Mandel, the use of the term eminent domain in the bill. What happens to potentially to the lands that are lakeshore leases and so on, where families have long-term interests through long-term leases, and would they be subject to condemnation? And that would be Mr. Mandel, I assume, being that you manage the lands for the Department of Natural Resources. Vandalin? Vandalin?
Yes,
excuse me.
Madam Chair, Aaron Vandalin with a V. Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the land exchange is one option of how we manage the lands. We will be looking at doing land exchanges to get some of the lands that Mr. Arnasty was speaking to out of public ownership, or actually staying in public ownership, but removing that trust obligation from those lands so that they can remain in that their natural state, if you will. With respect to the lakeshore leases, that was a project that happened in the late 90s, early 2000s. Still have roughly 100 that are still paying on their contract for deeds, if you will. Most of them have been bought out. We have roughly 40 or 50 that were never offered and haven't been sold. We would not look to take away anybody's property rights through this kind of condemnation. They actually have a vested interest in those under their contract for deeds.
Well,
Zeph Carlson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, when you use the term in the bill, eminent domain, you may not have that intent, but it looks to me like you perhaps would have the power to. Now then, whether you exercise that or not would be a slightly different question.
Specifically 111 and 112, is that language that fits what you, the answer you just gave us?
Madam Chair, yes, I believe it does fit exactly to actually buy out the trust. You actually have, the state would have to exercise its eminent domain powers and declare the public purpose to be natural resource or recreation purposes. The Attorney General has signed off on that's a legitimate use of eminent domain powers by the state. The state constitution requires that all school trust lands be sold at public auction. So that sale requirement is being met through eminent domain, and that Attorney General has issued an opinion that that's a legitimate use of eminent domain.
Madam Chair, I suspect there's the potential where we may hear from some people who have an interest in some of those lakeshore leases and ownership with the use of the word eminent domain. It looks to me like it's broad enough where that could conceivably happen, and I think if we move in this direction, we want to make sure that when he references, Madam Chair, that period in the 1990s, that's when I chaired the commission, and believe me, there's a lot of emotional involvement when you get involved with those lakeshore leases and so on, and a lot of compromise was reached at the time, and Mr. Vandeline commented about some of that, you know, where it was sold at public auction and one thing and another, but I just, with the word it's eminent domain, I think we should clarify if we move forward with this, what it means relative to things like lakeshore leases. Otherwise, you're going to get barrage members.
And you have further, otherwise, I'm. Did you want to add to this issue? Otherwise, what I'm...
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, thank you for that comment. And as Aaron Vandalindy mentioned, that's not the intention of the DNR, and it certainly would be appropriate to put a sentence in saying that this would not apply for any of those lands with lakeshore leases. That's not the intended use of this. It's really about the state making a declaration that certain lands should be managed for natural resource values and the trust will be compensated through these proceeds, and we're not talking about those lakeshore leases.
So we're going to work on clarifying language, I think, there, and should this be in the bonding bill, I have a feeling that that would be the part of the bill that we would maybe invite more testimony on that day with some clarifying language. Did you have a follow-up?
Well, Madam Chair, his comments, if we did that, would satisfy that. I was just trying to say we should exercise some caution on that issue.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. And I just wanted to do a follow-up with Mr. Vandalin on the minerals lease issue. Just last year alone, the mining industry paid $50 million into the school trust land, and that goes to K-12 schools all over the state. So a very significant contribution to school trust land comes from mining. So I'm just... You know, I guess I was, maybe I'm not tracking, but I'm trying to figure out how this would work on the school trust lands with the severed mineral rights, and you raised that, you know, that could be an issue or consideration. I'm just wondering if you could explain to me a little further on how that would play out.
Now, one of the, I would reference the school board letter because Ms. Denise Dietrich references the fact that there is some of the land, in fact, that can generate revenue through exactly the issues that you're talking about. And I think we're talking about those school trust lands that really would not be raising that kind of revenue, and we're trying to say how can we maximize the revenue on that.
Well, yes, Madam Chair, and especially because the bill says that an appraisal of the land is not required and the value determination of the school trust land shall be done in a manner developed by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. So I'm just trying to figure out how that would play out with the severed mineral rights.
Well, I think those two questions are probably the ones, Mr. Arnasty and others, that that we would want to do some work and probably visit individual members of the committee as this moves forward. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like a little clarification here because there's a lot of stuff getting thrown out here, but if I break this down correctly, and tell me if I'm wrong, what this is basically doing is taking bonding money and giving a chunk of bonding money to the schools so we can give DNR the authority to stop any mining of the resources underneath this property. Is that basically what this is going to do?
Mr. Arnott.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, most of this property right now is, for example, categories that fall into this non-revenue generating property includes 86,000 acres of school trust lands in the boundary waters by federal law designated non-revenue generating, essentially. We have miles and miles of lakeshore across the state in different places that are in undeveloped states. Highest and best use would say we'd sell that all off for lakeshore development housing. There's public value in retaining fish spawning habitat, wild shorelines. There's boat ramps on some of these, which are public access points, non-revenue generating. There's designated old growth forests where the DNR Division of Forestry has identified unique slivers and fragments of early forests in Minnesota. There's native prairies, as Mr. Chaplin mentioned, 7,200 acres of native prairies where we have less than 1% of our original native prairie. These are all lands that right now are not generating revenue. It's not directed at stopping mining per se. It's directed at maintaining and preserving natural resource values that have already been recognized in these lands, but we have a conflict with the fiduciary responsibility with the trust holders to say we've got to find a way to generate revenue. And what we are proposing is that the state, all of us, recognize both responsibilities, both environmental and educational responsibilities, and use some bonding proceeds to compensate the trust on a financial side so that we can manage these unique natural heritage treasures for the long haul.
This might have been one of those good ideas a long, long time ago, the whole concept of school trust lands, and I think many states kind of got out of the business of school trust lands a long time ago, just because of the kind of controversy that this raises, and so they've sort of moved on. We didn't. We sort of stayed stuck at that particular place with the expectation, but the promise unrealized. And I think this is one of the this bill is perhaps one of those ideas that might move us to a different point in the discussion. So, Representative Green, did you have follow-up?
Yeah, I do. The whole concept of the school trust land was to generate revenue for schools, and so if that best practices does that, then that's what should be done. And to stop that process, for whatever reason, goes against the whole idea of why we had the school trust lands in the first place. Furthermore, if this is a conservation question, then this should be before environmental or possibly legacy, because we already have money set aside for the DNR to purchase this land, which in my opinion is wrong anyway, because you're taking it out of the tax base, and now you're asking the taxpayers, who you just removed their property, to pay you back in the form of bonding. It all comes from the same pocket. And so I think this is a bad deal. I hope that a lot of this stuff gets straightened out before we consider it for bonding.
Representative Albright has a question.
And to Representative Green's point, and just to follow on to the earlier statement from Mr. Arnosti, correct me if I'm wrong, but it would appear on the face that, in a sense, we're buying land from ourselves or paying ourselves for land we already own. Could you expound on why I'm wrong?
The schools. I mean, in a sense, it's we're... The schools technically have the interest, and they haven't received the interest. And this is this bill would be to say, okay, we're going to let the schools have the interest in it, and we're going to deal with it in a different way. I think, Mr. Arnosti, isn't that?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, speaking as a Minnesota citizen and a taxpayer myself, I look at it this way: I value both for my children. I value both their natural heritage and these unique natural resources, and their education. I have set aside funds. My kids are actually in college right now, so they're expended. But I have set aside funds for their college education over the course of their upbringing. And this is actually trying to safeguard both the fiduciary responsibility for us collectively to make sure that these lands in some form generate revenue to educate our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. And, in my view, it's an equal moral, legal, and ethical responsibility to make sure that they are inheriting elements of the earth that we were given. And really, we're talking about unique fragments and remnants. We're talking about undeveloped lakeshore. We're talking about old growth forests. We're talking about native prairies. We're talking about special wildlife management areas, things that have been identified by scientists as something special. To me, that's equally compelling. And I think that's a Minnesota value that Minnesota taxpayers have indicated time and time again. They are willing to support both education and the environment.
And the one bit of confusion I think that's here, and I think we're not going to resolve this today. I think this was an introduction to the concept, and we're going to have to end this now. But I think there's a feeling among some on the committee that we're selling a lot of privately owned land. And maybe that's one bit of clarification as we educate the committee that we're going to have to make clear.
Thank you, Madam.
So it is not in possession of our committee. I don't know what other committees it is being heard in, but at least the concept has been introduced here for a little bit of introduction for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And Representative Davids, we're moving to your bills now, and we'll start. And again, we don't have either of these in our possession, so we're not moving them. But we'll start with House File 556. And you're joined by Joel Young and Mike Martin.
What do you think?
And members, you're getting a packet.
Is this a good deal? Or not?
And Representative Davids, are you leading off?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this informational hearing on House File 556. I have with me today the City Clerk of Chatfield, Joel Young, and Mr. Mike Martin, who has worked very diligently on this project over the years. And I would be remiss, Madam Chair, if I did not personally thank you for your support of this project over the years. For new committee members, this was passed through the bonding committee several years ago. It was in the bonding bill. It went to Governor Pawlenty at that time, and it was line item vetoed out of the bill. So this project has had many hearings over the years and has been included. It was deemed as a worthy project by this very bonding committee in previous years, and didn't quite get across the finish line. So we have two folks from the City of Chatfield that would like to testify. I'll start out with Mr. Joel Young.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Joel Young. As Mr. Davids has said, I'm joined with by Mr. Michael Martin. He's president of the Chatfield Center for the Arts. And also in the audience is Mr. Robert Peterson, a council member from the City of Chatfield. Since beginning formal operations in 2010, the Chatfield Center for the Arts has attracted musicians, authors, actors, speakers, and others from across the country and internationally. Over the past 2 years, there have been over 10,000 visits to the center each year, either to participate in activities or as spectators. Although located in a small community, deed records indicate that there are approximately 640,000 residents living within a 60-mile radius of the center. The center is capable of accommodating large numbers of people, since proving its value to the region. The Chatfield Center is a key part of the social and cultural infrastructure in the southeast portion of Minnesota. There's simply no other venue quite like it. In addition to its 900 seats and huge proscenium stage, the center also boasts an intimate performance space capable of only 100 people, where no one is further than 25 feet from the performers. With your help, a third space will be created that would accommodate a group of 400 people. This would result in three distinctly different environments, flexibility that would accommodate all sorts of cultural activities and community gatherings of all kinds. For those of you who have been to Chatfield, you know that we're working with two really special buildings, one constructed in 1916 and one constructed in 1936. Unfortunately, designers of buildings of those days were not particularly concerned with energy efficiency, and they certainly did not accommodate the needs of people with disabilities. With your help, these buildings will be made accessible for all people, and the loss of precious energy through the windows, the roof, and the HVAC system will be stopped. Energy efficiency is a key component of sustainability as we move forward. Over the last 3 years, the center has attracted a number of grants and donations, which has allowed small but significant physical improvements. In that same time frame, by using our own cash and other proceeds, the center has injected almost $1 million into the state's economy. The businesses that benefit by that center go way beyond musicians and artists, and the impact goes well beyond Chatfield, too. In addition to local and regional companies, these dollars have been paid out to various professionals, artists, contractors from Austin, St. Cloud, Duluth, and throughout the metro area. Although the center is staffed by volunteers, the economic impact is very real. And so, too, is the impact on the jobs of the vendors that service the center. Every job that this center supports is in the private sector. Granting this request would make a noticeable impact in southeast Minnesota immediately and over time. This is exactly the type of infrastructure that's needed to attract and retain a quality workforce as Rochester and the surrounding area grows, and immediately several dozen construction jobs would be created, and then several other dozen jobs would be created and induced throughout the region. A fully functioning arts center is the best opportunity to impact our economy in southeast Minnesota and to facilitate job creation in the area. This center builds on the natural heritage of the community. It complements a very thriving tourist industry, and it offers a size and style of performance venue that's just not found in the area. For your reference, as you see there, we've provided an information packet. In it, you'll find a redevelopment plan, an economic impact analysis, a job creation report. You'll also find a preservation plan that was approved by SHPO to guide the improvement of the buildings as we move forward, some pre-design work, and a one-page summary of the project.
And members, I hope you've had a chance to look through the folder. You know, one of the things I think that each of these towns does a very good job of is telling us the story of the economic impact. Representative Davids has had experience of that in Lanesboro, where there was some investment that transformed a town, and they tell the story very well. And you've done that here. The Capital Investment Committee has visited twice. Once to look at a very unique collection of music that exists only there and is something of a national treasure, and then we visited again to the Potter Center, and I you're right, I do have great affection for this project, and in this little folder, when they talk about the vision, I mean, there are really two pieces to this: to create a sustainable attraction for culture, education, entertainment, economic development that will enhance the quality of life, while preserving the historical importance of the most prominent, architecturally significant, and well-known building in downtown Chatfield. And then, as you see with some of the other pieces, it is incorporated into the economic vision of the town. So, Mr. Martin, do you have additional?
Just a little bit, thank you, Madam Chairman. What Mr. Young has described and what's included in the packet that you received is a functioning cultural and community center that can meet the needs of the city of Chatfield and the surrounding area. Because of what their structures are, their size and their construction, we believe that they're capable of taking the next step, possibly the next two steps, into becoming a robust piece of the cultural and tourism life of the entire state. When the Pazzo Auditorium and the adjacent high school were built, they were built state-of-the-art. There is room and there is power there that can be used for things that haven't been invented even yet. But there's plenty of room for the things that we want to do. However, they were built for a different type of reality. When the Potter Auditorium was built, one-third of the inductees that were being drafted into the Army were being rejected as undernourished. The shape of people have changed since then. The seats are built 18 inches wide, and that is not adequate for today. That's one of the things we need to change. Speaking of seats, Potter Auditorium was built to hold 916 people. It has one women's bathroom stall, one men's bathroom stall. That's not adequate. It was probably not adequate then, but it's certainly not adequate now. When the 1916 high school was built, coal cost $1 a ton, and insulation was expensive. The building was designed so that the heat would escape through the roof and melt the snow off the top. So the roof was not designed to hold any snow load at all, maybe an inch, maybe two, but it was designed to melt through. That needs to be changed. The bones of the building are still sound, but some of the pipes and the wiring are almost 100 years old. They need to be replaced. Those are the kind of things that we're asking for help with from this committee. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you've got.
Thank you very much for being here. I think Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Been there several times.
Yes, and we've supported the project in the past. I did have two questions. The first is of Representative Davids. I'm just wondering what his commitment to the project is, because he usually wears a cap designating his support for various communities in his district. Which cap would you have worn if you would have been here properly attired today?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Carlson. Maroon and gold with a real nice C on it.
Those of us that have been here before understand what what that's about. But my serious question, though, Madam Chair, that's serious, I guess, yeah, but the $415,000 in cash contributions from the school district, where do those funds come from within the school district? And the reason I'm raising the question, I remember a while back, it was either the Bacchus or the Hackensack school district came in, and they wanted to use school district operating funds for the remodeling of a building. And they were told in a rather firm way by the Education Committee that those dollars were available for programs for children and not for facilities and remodeling and additions and that kind of thing, whatever that particular project was. So that $415,000, what pot of money does that come out of, if any of you know, from the school district side?
I think Mr. Young is prepared to answer that.
I'll give that a try, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I can't identify exactly what pot of money the school district used from it, but I can explain to you the genesis of this whole project and how the city and the school have worked together. The reason these buildings became available is because the school district had passed a referendum to build a new elementary school and to add on and renovate a high school. And also in their plans was to demolish most of what we're talking about here. And it was determined over a fairly short period of time, several months, that it wasn't in the best interest of the community to demolish those buildings. It was also quickly determined that the school district was not in a position to try to rehab these buildings or turn them into something else. They're in the business of education. And so the city of Chatfield, through its EDA and the school district, worked together to transfer the property along with cash that had been designated for demolition funds and asbestos abatement to the city and the EDA to do some of those same activities. And so specifically which pot of money they got it from, I don't know, but I can tell you it's from that arena of activity that the dollars came from.
Okay. Madam Chair, then it doesn't sound like that 415 is in direct competition for programs for children then.
Absolutely not, sir.
Okay, that was the main reason for my question. Thank you.
And we have a question. Line 114 to 116, no money may be appropriated for this project before June 1, 2014. What's the explanation for that?
Yes, so what that is going with the idea that the bonding year would be in the even year, we would be appropriating money. The theory here is to have a hearing during the spring, having the bonding committee travel to Chatfield to take a look at the project, and then hopefully next spring in the bonding bill, it would be included in the bonding bill in the bonding year is the theory. But now those decisions, of course, that could be changed, but those decisions are not really in my hands. They'll be a pay grade or two above me.
Okay. All right. That's helpful clarification. Yeah. You just never know. Next year is an unknown, isn't it?
We don't know, Madam Chair.
I think we have no further questions, so thank you very much, and we'll transition to Preston.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Does Representative Davids want me to run up to his office to get the hats?
I need a different one now.
Well, that's what I was wondering because I've not been on this committee, but as at least Madam senior member, if he wants me to run up and get some hats,
he's offering. I think that's a serious offer. Representative Davids to House File 1596 again. That bill is not in our possession, but we're hearing it for information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1596, and again, thank you for hearing this on an informational basis, and we'll try and work out the logistics of getting the actual bills to this committee. This bill has also been heard in the past, but I do not believe this one went as far as actually being included and then being vetoed and all those types of things. But this is a bill we've heard in the past, a very worthy project in the city of Preston.
Members, I should say, I think this is being handed out, and we did confirm before we gave them permission that the value of this was under $5. So we've already checked that out for you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is an appropriation for the National Trout Center that is already up and running in the city of Preston. We've been looking at this for several years and have worked, the National Trout Center Board has worked closely with another favorite in southeastern Minnesota, the Wabasha National Eagle Center, and we're trying to kind of design this after that facility there that's been quite successful. So with me, I have Dr. Spangler with me today, who would like to make a presentation to the committee, then we'll stand for questions.
We're like children in a
You said Dr. Spangler? Do we also have, is it, we had John?
We had Mr. Goucher. We're switching for Mr. Spangler. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
We also have Kathy Enerson from the Preston EDA, City Administrator Joe Hoffman, and who am I missing?
Keith Searson. Keith is our Director of Programs.
Oh, he's okay. Okay, the Director of the National Trout Center.
Dr. Spangler?
Madam Chair, honorable representatives, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today to promote our program, which we believe is in the best interest not only of the residents of Preston, but also the state of Minnesota. We are, as Representative Davids mentioned, we are building our National Trout Center on the basis of the very successful business plan of the National Eagle Center. We have had our business plan vetted, feasibility study based upon what we believe we can do with this center, and much of what I want to present today comes from that analysis. You have in your packet a statistical trout. The National Trout Center wants to celebrate the trout as an icon within our public, within our culture. I don't need to remind you that Minnesota has the highest per capita number of license sales, fishing license sales, anywhere in the United States. We sell between 1.2 and 1.4 million licenses for fishing in the state, and we have well over 90,000 individual trout stamp validations of those licenses, indicating that there is a significant interest among our fisheries for the trout resource itself. Our Environmental Learning Center at the National Trout Center has operated for 3 years out of a storefront location on the town square at Preston, Minnesota. We hope to bring, through education, practice, and awareness, an understanding of the cold water environments so that we can engage our public to understand what is necessary for proper stewardship and development of these resources. As an environmental learning center, we have incorporated and are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our fiduciary agent in requests for funding through the state is the City of Preston, and we've been strongly supported not only by the city itself but by local philanthropic organizations to get our program started. I'd like to talk for just a moment about our economic stake in the trout fishery in southeastern Minnesota. The contributions of that fishery across the entire driftless area, that is the unglaciated region of the upper Midwest Mississippi River Valley, is $1.1 billion annually. This is a return that contrasts with about one-third of the value of Wisconsin's dairy industry. It also is approximately a third of Minnesota's receipts from the corn and dairy products in its agricultural industry. So this is not small potatoes. These are not small trout. Our native trout is the brook trout, and that's the one that you have in your creel. It has a special significance, cultural significance, because we can showcase southeastern Minnesota in the driftless region as a place where stream rehabilitation, conservation, and reconstruction efforts have been entirely successful in bringing forward a very valuable natural resource for continuing use into the future. We can be proud of those accomplishments, and we believe that we can further them through the efforts of the National Trout Center to educate our public. You'll notice that on the statistical fish, we have more than 450 miles of trout stream restoration to our credit over the past 25 years in the driftless area, 450 miles. For every dollar spent on stream restoration, we get an annual return of $24.50. Every dollar provides an annual return of $24.50 in value of the fishery every year. In Minnesota alone, we have over 530 miles of public access easements, so much of that fishery is available to the public. You can go out there, walk along the stream course, unencumbered by concerns about the landowner's private property rights, knowing full well that that resource is completely available to the Minnesota public. We also want to point out that we're not talking about a very small and local influence. We're talking about a regional value and a statewide value that pales in comparison to many of our other activities. For example, the non-resident anglers that come to the driftless area provide 47% of the direct expenditures that go into the trout fishery. We have an opportunity to use this interest in our fishery to bring people here, not only from elsewhere in the state of Minnesota, but also from other states. Ms. Enerson has a little chart there, a pie chart, that will show the proportion of individuals that come to the Trout Center from outside Fillmore County. From other areas in the state of Minnesota, the pink region on the chart, from other areas outside of the state, and therefore bringing revenue into the state of Minnesota, the little green area. And the sum total over the first 2 years of operation at our Trout Center was 76% of the visitors to the Trout Center actually came in from outside of Fillmore County. So this has statewide impact, and we're very pleased that there is a broad interest in this fishery. Our project will be to build a permanent home for the National Trout Center. Our site in Preston, Minnesota, on the south branch of the Root River, is illustrated in this chart. We have had It's right in the heart of the city of Preston, and the stream course flows through the city for approximately a mile. We have had the Center for Rural Design at the University of Minnesota develop an artist's conception of what our permanent home might look like, and the illustration on the easel now shows a young visitor to the proposed center looking into the living stream. The living stream will be an exhibit feature within that building, unlike anything else in the United States. There's only one other living stream exhibit in the United States, and that's at Darby Creek in Ohio, and their focus is not on cold water communities as ours is, but rather on a cool water community. Here, students, children, adults, people of all ages and abilities will be able to peer into a living stream and find out what makes the cold water environment of our trout such a special and significant feature of our landscape. There's another illustration here showing how the National Trout Center permanent home would be sited on the shores of the on the banks of the south branch of the Root River. And here is an aerial view with the Trout Center identified near the middle upper portion of the illustration. Kathy, can you point that out for us? Right there. And it's surrounded by parts of the Root River State Trail, which provides over 40 miles of cycling opportunity and hiking opportunity and skiing. It's right on the banks of the river, and it showcases a limestone bluff on the far side of the river, which is largely responsible for the kind of cool water environment that we have for our trout.
We're just curious. We're just looking at this particular one. It, where the red star is, if is that the location that the center looks removed from the?
Yes, the red star is our temporary location in the on the town square in Preston, and the actual location of the trout permanent home, the Trout Center permanent home, would be down on the river. So, we have been blessed by a recognition that Preston is the heart of the trout fishery here in Minnesota. We call it the trout capital of Minnesota, and it has that designation through the legislature. It adjoins one of the most popular hiking, biking, skiing trails in the state. It's within 35 miles of the Mayo Clinic and the urban center at Rochester. It's just upstream from the bed and breakfast capital of Minnesota, and that's Lanesboro, of course. Our building will accommodate visitors to the area in a number of different rooms. We have a multi-purpose room that can be used not only for Trout Center events, but also an opportunity for other civic events to be held within the confines of the Trout Center. We don't currently have a civic space of that kind, of that size, available in Preston. And we would have also workrooms, workshops, library space, conference rooms, in addition to the Living Stream exhibit. I'd like to point out that the special features of our environmental curriculum include introducing learners to the ideal characteristics that we have in our water supply for southeastern Minnesota. The karst geology there, exhibited in the beautiful blufflands that are exposed to view that rim the river, are going to be visible from the Trout Center, and they are going to be explained in kiosks and exhibits that help the learner to understand the relationship between the geology and the water quality that supports our trout fishery. In this illustration, we have a 9-hole fishing course. This runs right through an 8/10 of a mile of stream course. This runs right through the city of Preston, and it encourages visitors to come and play each of those 9 holes, catch what trout they can, learn from the fact that each of them offers a different kind of water and a different kind of fishing experience, learn what some of the aquatic features are that support our trout population, and all of this within the metaphor of a nine-hole golfing expedition. So we can keep scorecards right there at the Trout Center. People can compare their catch with what others have done. We think that this is an excellent teaching tool and one that people will appreciate as a memorable part of their visit to the Driftless area in Minnesota. In summary, I'd like to point out that this is an economic engine for southeast Minnesota. We have a $1.1 billion recreational fishery in this region, in the Driftless region. The actual expenditures by anglers, direct expenditures in that fishery, amount to over $600 million. By adding the multiplying factor that economists believe is realistic for this fishery, and by the way, that factor is only 1.4. It's not the outlandish 5 and 6 and 7 factor multipliers that you see in some proposals. With a 1.4 multiplier, it's clear that the $1.1 billion estimate, if anything, is an underestimate of the true value of that fishery. We can compare that with the proceeds from the 5 professional sports teams in Chicago and find that they total up only about $800 million. Our fishery is worth more than that by a substantial margin. Our tourism industry in the state of Minnesota is worth about $11 billion. We're talking about a tenth of it right here in this small region in southeastern Minnesota. We know that we can develop a trout center that will attract more people to the region than currently visit. Our Whitewater State Park had over 250,000 visitors last year. If only a small fraction of those people came over to Preston to see the Root River Valley, just because the permanent home of the Trout Center is exhibiting our resources, we could represent a substantial, appreciate a substantial increase in our cash flow in the tourism industry. So we believe this is an economic engine. We believe it is an extraordinary opportunity for education of an experiential kind that will encourage lifelong learning among our citizens. Your packet of information includes a more comprehensive guide to the economic value of the recreational fishery. Behind this lies a 55-page report, which is available through the Trout Center if you want to do further analysis. Also in your packet is a collection of articles that have been written about the Trout Center, a brief summary of some of the programs that we've held at the Trout Center.
And I'm going to interrupt you because we're going to move to questions because we have one more bill, Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, on the handout that we received, this one here that you commissioned, on page 14, you described the location, and the location would be, as you point out, in the floodplain. And, Madam Chair, what comes to my mind when I read that page was that what we've tried to attempt, for example, in the city of Austin about the removing construction on the floodplain there. I forget what the name of the river there is, but also the Red River up between Minnesota and Dakota. And so my question basically, and I know you talk about constructing it at a little higher level on the first level, but just simply the wisdom when we're trying to move away of building on the floodplain. And I'm not trying to be distracting about the project itself, but simply the location.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's an excellent question, and we are in consideration of that fact, understanding what the construction constraints have to be in order for the building to withstand an occasional flood. And our design considerations will allow floodwaters to actually exceed the lower level of that building when it is finally constructed. I would point out that it is in the floodplain, not the floodway. The distinction that is made by our national offices of emergency measures recognize that the building itself will not be an impediment to the flow rates under flood conditions of the South Branch of the Root River. So that is a design consideration, and it's taken into account in our planning.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a quick one, because I know you want to move along, but let me ask the question this way. Were there other potential sites that would not have been in the floodplain that would have reduced the need for that first level to be specially constructed?
Madam Chair, Representative
like
Carlson.
Would it, Representative Davids, were you going to speak to that?
No, I just wanted to mention that my house is right here.
Oh.
And here's Highway 52, so when Representative Lilly was going down to Luther, just if you're coming down to Preston, just stop in at
the time. Okay, right, Dr. Spangler.
I'm right on the river. It's the one that says vote for Davids.
Or we could meet at the Branding Iron.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, excellent question, and there are alternative sites. The city of Preston, municipality of Preston, is looking at other locations that might well be more suitable from the standpoint of the possible flooding on the first level. So this is not graven in stone. This is a site that we believe is optimal, but there are other areas under consideration as well.
Representative Dean.
Me, Dean? Not that one. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so you know, on the drive-in this morning, I was listening about this project. And in some ways, I disagreed with those individuals. I think that this project and the previous project point out how many of our smaller cities in the state of Minnesota have these unique attributes that I think are important. And I think that's really what makes Minnesota what it is. And so I think this is a great project.
Was somebody already picking on them on the radio?
I have this weird affinity to listen to Davis and Emmer when I drive in. So
I've been abused.
There is treatment.
That's fine.
Representative Earhart?
Madam Chair, thank you. How close to Rochester are you?
Madam Chair,
Representative Davids.
35. I just wondered if there's somewhere you could hook.
Just because the tape has to pick it up. The question was how far from Rochester?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, about 35 to 40 miles.
Okay, Madam Chair, I was just wondering if you couldn't hook up with their rate on their treasury there. This is only $4.5 million and maybe, or $1 million, and you could maybe add on to their enormous amount that they want and make it an attraction that they don't have. That would help. I don't know, is that a possibility?
Madam Chair and Representative Earhart, I'm certainly open to that. I would like to just comment, though, the reason that we feel it needs to be down there is because of the living stream issue, because so we'd be right there.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to a point in terms of the ancillary support services that the town itself would be able currently and or in the future to support to this this vision, I'm just wondering whether or not this would overwhelm the infrastructure, or if there are planning in place in anticipation of this project, how that would be accommodated.
Good question.
Madam Chair, honorable representatives, our business plan is intended to identify a path to sustainability in the financial sense for the Trout Center. We have two scenarios within the feasibility analysis of our business plan that suggest that we can become a self-sustaining entity within possibly as little as 15 years. A more optimistic scenario says 10 years. A less optimistic one says a little bit longer. The intent is to have the revenues generated by the National Trout Center support its activity.
Because there would be admission. There would be an admission.
There would be admission. And this is
the Eagle Center.
That's exactly correct, Madam Chair. We want that living stream exhibit, especially because it will be unique and it will be worth charging admission for, and we're confident that there will be a public to support it.
Representative Lilly, and then we're going to have to close because we've got one more bill we want to get.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Davids, I really care about both your projects. The Chatfield one, I think, is a true treasure, and this one is going to be great when it becomes a reality. I know I work in Delta Airlines, and a lot of folks travel in to go trout fishing in our state, right pretty close to Representative Atkins' home in Dakota County. I mean,
in very close to the metro. They'll fly in and to fish trout, and certainly I could see folks. I mean, obviously they're obviously going down in southeastern Minnesota already to fish, but this will be a real nice enhancement to the tourism and to the area already that you've already kind of established. So we're counting on you, Representative Davids. We need your vote. Let's get her done.
Thank you so much for being here, and we're going to move on to the...
And the revenue.
By the way, members, Representative Fisher is in another committee, and we some time ago told his testifier that we weren't going to do his, so we're just going to end with Representative McNamer. And Representative McNamer, because you have several testifiers, I think we'll give them priority because you're a part of our committee, and you can always... fill us in again later, so we'll just make sure particularly we've got a few people from out of town.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much. And again, House File 320 is also not in our possession, but it looks like at least Mr. Eisenbacher is from out of town, so if we could get our out-of-town speakers...
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Jay McNamer. I represent District 12A. Today I have Mr. Hinckley, Mr. Piper, and Mr. Eisenbacher, who would be willing to speak to my bill. We'll let them speak first, and we'll see what happens after that.
Mr. Eisenbacher, we'll start with you.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Mark Eisenbacher. I'm the Buildings and Grounds Director for Cambridge Isani Public Schools, and so for 18 years. I'm also the current state president of MASMIS, which is a Minnesota Association of School Maintenance Supervisors, comprised of over 600 facility management professionals working on the care and maintenance of facilities. So our district has been proactive in energy conservation, very, very much so in the last 7 to 8 years. In fact, in 2010, our school district was the first district in the state of Minnesota to achieve a 30% savings in energy. And we were the ninth school district in the nation to accomplish that 30% energy savings. After 8 years of focus on energy conservation, we currently have achieved 36% savings in our school district and saved our local taxpayers over $2.6 million. So in other words, if we had done nothing in the area of energy conservation, out of our general fund, our taxpayers would have had to come up with an additional $2.6 million. That would have been cuts to teachers, that would have been cuts to other essential staff. So that's been our focus, is to be as lean and mean as possible and to generate and to have facilities that not only are energy efficient but also maintain and meet healthy indoor air quality standards for our students. So I'm here today just to show my support for House File 320 and to emphasize the importance of giving local school boards levy authority without the approval of voters for these types of projects, because they are so important. We know that they do show results, and they will result in more dollars being focused toward the classroom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Piper, are you next? Or?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Michael Piper of Shakopee, Minnesota. I am a small business owner. We are in the business of energy-related projects and consult with many school districts across the state of Minnesota and in Wisconsin. The reason I mention that is because there's been similar legislation in Wisconsin that has produced an enormous amount of work on energy conservation in school buildings. What we would like to do is definitely show support for House File 320. We think that it does merit further consideration. We support particularly the concept of the bill for the school boards to have local control with the ability to levy for energy efficiency improvements. The one caveat that we promote, of course, is that there is a check and balance system so that you're not purchasing projects that may not have the expected return on investment, because as Mr. Eisenbacher indicated, who is also a client of mine, if it's done properly, it can result in a very substantial cost savings to a district, thus redirecting money into the classroom. So we very much support this bill, with the caveat that I don't know that we're going to get to amendments just yet, but we are working with Representative McNamer. We do have some suggestions on how we could make this to the point where a school district is not really taking any risk, but is actually investing in the future in their school district and making, at the same time, energy efficiency improvements, cost reduction strategies, and also upgrading infrastructure to school facilities. So we're here to support that. And, of course, after Mr. Hinkle is done, we'll be happy to entertain any questions.
And just to clarify, so you're still working on language to assure that what your outcome would be?
That is correct, Madam Chair. I believe there's been a couple of suggestions to Representative McNamer, and we are one group that does have some suggestions. So I think over the coming weeks we're going to be trying to work on that. And just kind of refine this, and then, of course, obviously taking into account what we hear today.
Not too much more time, but so we're starting to push a little bit.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Mr. Hinkle, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is...
Representative Swiecinski, was your question to
it
the...
Was to the guy on the end that just...
to the on the right?
Yes.
Okay, we'll take his question.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Just you kind of talked about how your district is saving money. Just from a, you know, kind of pure financial standpoint, looking at the total, you know, obviously you took a levy out to do the projects, the cost of the levy, the cost of the loan, and then do you have like paperwork with, or could you potentially just show kind of the savings on a month-to-month basis? Because I know generally electric rates have gone up over the past 10 years tremendously, and just like to see that change, if you actually are paying less than you did, or when you say savings, is it less than
when I was referring to our current 36% savings, that's units of energy. That is not cost.
Okay.
Cost fluctuates, but the units of energy are consistent. So that is what we're focusing on.
Okay. That's super. Thanks.
Welcome. Please identify yourself.
Again, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm Policy Director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, and I'm here today to lend support to Representative McNamer's bill, House File 320. We believe, MNSEA believes, this is a good bill, and we have discussed with the author and other key stakeholders, such as the Division of Energy Resources, some ideas to strengthen it and help school districts leverage further the loan dollars that are provided for in this bill to do deeper retrofits and even renewables. The question that this bill addresses is, how do we fix up our schools with constrained budgets? Representative McNamer's bill calls for a match, and in this case, potentially a match from private dollars for funds loaned and repaid from the savings and generation. The matching funds required by this bill could use the savings-only repayments with provisions of existing statutes that amended would allow school districts the flexibility to use longer-term financing up to 25 years as either a standalone school district project or a project as part of the state's Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. Amendments to enable school districts' participation in the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program with improved terms are moving with the energy omnibus bills in both the House and Senate, and I've drafted language for the author and council to consider for inclusion in this bill for school districts that would like to use the same favorable terms to choose to remain independent of the state's program. Strengthening an already good bill by providing more tools for our schools to do needed energy improvements. With that, I conclude and stand for questions.
Representative Norton.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'm going to have to look over this a little more carefully. I'm
appreciative of the idea here, and our school district's worked for a long time on energy conservation, and I think it's done a pretty good job, and I'm sure would have appreciated the help here. I just heard earlier on that there was a levy component to this, and I'm kind of quickly reading through the bill and trying to see where the levy fits in there. So can you explain to me how the levy relates to the revolving loan and the bonding, how those three components are working?
Yeah, Representative Norton.
Namer.
The levy would be allowed without voter, the school board wouldn't have to ask the voters to vote on it. It's under statute 212, if I'm not mistaken, 123.B, and then that would help match the funds that they can get from our revolving loan, which would help pay for the project. It's a good thing because it does not have, the school board does not have to ask the voters for a levy to raise property taxes. So it's one way of keeping property taxes down. And it's also access for money right away so they can get started on the project.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to look over this a little more carefully because I understand what you're saying, and that makes sense. As I'm reading this, I don't see anything about a levy. I see it says that you don't have to, that voters don't have to vote for the revenue, but I don't see permission to levy, or maybe that's already granted and you're wavering yourself from a provision currently in law. So I'm just not, it's just not clear.
That sounds like one of those issues in terms of language. If, you know, were this to move forward, that might be one of the points.
Okay, I can talk to Mr. or Representative.
Madam Chair, I think everyone's getting antsy. Should I present this on Tuesday?
Well, we have two more questions,
okay.
And the testifiers will only be here today, so let's get Representative Dean and Representative Green's questions, and then...
Dean or Hip
this,
Dean?
This Representative Dean.
Okay.
MD.
Nerdy Dean. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative McNamer. One of the things, and maybe this is for Deb Dyson, but one of the things that we're going to be seeing with a lot of these projects is the balance between installation of renewable energy features, solar panels or wind generators, versus energy conservation with lighting, with insulation, and with in their dollars that school districts can put into buildings. There's clearly a bent in lobbying and in interest towards renewables. When I learned from Representative Wagenius a long time ago that the quickest, fastest, best thing you can do is insulation if you're worried about greenhouse gases and you're worried about energy production and savings. And I'm just would encourage you to think about that, and think about that in the calculation, to be blind to solutions to help our school districts do the best they can with the energy and the very, very limited resources that many of our school districts have.
Sounds like a
thank you, Representative Dean. I think that was a statement.
Yeah. Advice, I think. Mr. Hinkle, did you have something to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, you know, our interest in this bill from the standpoint of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association is far from exclusive and focused on renewables. What we've seen is that it's become increasingly difficult for school districts, public jurisdictions, and state buildings, all of which are governed by three different statutory provisions for guaranteed energy savings, to continue to get the deep retrofits that include HVAC systems, that include windows, that include those elements, energy conservation measures that you so rightly point to as being a necessary focus for this within the current provisions of the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. So extending the terms and the amortization gives us opportunity to go deeper and get to the kinds of energy conservation measures that would be more difficult to fund with shorter amortization.
Representative Green.
Thank you. I do hope you come back, because I'll have more questions than we have time to ask today, but I have just a couple things here. The one, when you're talking about removing the authority of the people to vote on their own levy, I have a real problem with that. The schools are suffering from some added cost from energy. In my opinion, one of those costs is the fact that we're forced to do renewables that are costing us tons of money, especially in the rural area. And so are your homeowners. And so if you're going to ding them again now without even a vote, that's going to be a real problem. I think you can expect some emails on that. But you made a comment that by taking the authority away from the people to vote on this and allowing the schools to levy the tax, it's going to keep property taxes down. Can you explain that to me?
That sounds like if we were to include this, I think it goes to Representative Norton's question, too. So I think both of you had some clarification on that. And so I think there, were this to be included in a bonding bill, I think that's one of the issues that we want to get some clarification and understand language. So we unfortunately, our time is up, and I think there's another committee coming up here. Representative Lilly, have you
Thank
had
you,
a
gentlemen.
Chance to look at the
We've
minutes
got to get together.
On March 19th?
I'd be happy to move them.
Any other changes? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those
aye.
Opposed? Those minutes are approved. And members, when we on Tuesday, April 2nd, we have two issues. We didn't put them on your agenda. Veterans Affairs will be here. That, believe it or not, that's a very, very complicated issue. Not that we aren't going to totally secure housing for veterans, but where do we build it? So the Veterans Affairs will be in here. And then we have two school bills that were referred to us because they were built with DO bonding. If you transfer management, we actually have to look at them. So those will be before us. Meeting is adjourned.